Each week when we come together, we bring with us a spark of the light that burns within us. And from those many sparks, we kindle our common flame. As Nancy Moldari lights our chalice this morning, I invite you to be attentive to the words of the Buddha as sung by the choir. This month is the Buddha's birthday. In some parts of Asia, it's a month-long celebration. And I understand that when the Reverend Don Kafka was serving here as minister, he would always acknowledge that holiday and bring out his statue of the Buddha for our Sunday morning service. And although we are not a tradition of churches filled with statues and religious images and objects, I decided to dust off his Buddha and bring it out today to remind us of the many and rich deep connections between Buddhism and Unitarian Universalism. We are a religion that is rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition, but in the past 200 years, Buddhist thought and later Buddhist practice has entered our tradition. And there are many parallels between Buddhist teachings and UU principles. The Buddha's given name was Siddhartha Gautama. So how did he become the Buddha? Well, he had many followers, and one day some of them asked him not just who he was, but what he was. Are you a god, they asked, and he said, no. Are you an angel, they asked, and he said, no. Are you a saint, they asked, and he said, no. Then what are you, they asked. He said, I am awake, and that became his new name. That is what Buddha means. I am awake. The Buddha is the one who woke to see and understand things about how we should live our lives in order to have true happiness. So Buddhism, one of the world's great religions, started because one man woke up. Our own religious tradition calls us to wake up to the needs of the world and to wake up to our spiritual needs, to awaken our minds and our hearts in our conscience, in our vision. Religion is, in essence, and at many different levels, a call to be awake. Please be seated and attentive to a special message from our DRE.
Good morning. I want to wish a happy Mother's Day to all the moms and the moms-to-be that are here. And since we won't be here to honor Father's Day, a happy early Father's Day to all the dads and the dads-to-be that are here as well. I have a story that to share with you today that's adapted from a book called Busy, Busy, Busy. It's a children's book written by Jonathan Shipton. And it's a particular story that I shared a couple of years ago, and it still resonates with me because it's something I have to work really hard on. And it's a daily struggle for me to remember some of the messages that are in this story. It's about moms, but I also want you to think about how busy dads and moms are when they get doing all the things that need to be done. One day, there was a little boy who just wanted to play with his mom, but she was just in a bad mood. She wouldn't give him a cookie, read him a story, or do anything with him. His mom said there was just too much to do. She had beds to make, meals to cook, and clothes to wash. She said she was chained to the kitchen sink all day long. She told the boy he had to go away and play by himself, and he did. He even went upstairs and sorted out his farm and tidied up his cars. He even found a lost sock. But the whole time he could still hear his mom crashing around with her bad mood. Then suddenly, the whole house was quiet. The little boy held his breath. He listened very hard, but he couldn't hear a thing. So he tiptoed down the stairs to see what was going on. The kitchen door was open a tiny crack, and he peeked inside. There was the little boy's mom. Her hands were stuck in the sink. Two big tears rolled down her cheeks. In a flash, the little boy jumped onto a chair. He wiped away his mom's tears. He gave her a great big kiss. Then he pulled her arms away from the water and shouted snip, snip, snip to those invisible chains that tied her to the sink. "Come on, Mom," he said, "before it's too late." So he grabbed her hand, and they ran down the hall into the sunshine, just the two of them, just in time. I really like the reminders that this story gives. Yes, we have to do all the chores that we must do, but we also need to remember that sometimes we just blink and our kids have grown. So to all the kids with moms and dads here who you see get so busy with all their work and chores, remember that if you help them with their work will go twice as fast and not seem so awful. So right now, I see some kids not sitting with their parents. So I'm going to ask you to get up and find your parent. And listen, I want you to look at them and tell them one thing that you will do to help them out this week. So, and if everyone's told their parent one thing that they're going to do for them this week, now, parents, I want you to tell your kids one thing that you will do with them this week. Okay. And now, if you want, you can pinky swear to this. So make a pinky swear with your kids. Kids, make them with your parents that you will keep your promise to do what you told your parents you would do to help them out. And parents, probably even harder to make the promise to make sure to spend that time with your kids. So enjoy your day and happy Mother's Day.
May I be silent and listen.
Our reading is from the sermon at Benares, the Buddha's first sermon after his enlightenment. The enlightened person does not speak a spiritual life in self-punishment, but neither does he indulge in worldly pleasures or live in abundance. The enlightened person finds the middle path. There are two extremes, brethren, which ought to be avoided. What are these two extremes? A life given to pleasures, devoted to pleasures and lust. This is degrading, sensual, vulgar, ignoble, profitless. And a life given to mortification. This is painful, ignoble, profitless. But avoiding these two extremes, I have gained knowledge of the middle path, which leads to insight, which leads to wisdom, which conduces to calm, to knowledge, and to supreme enlightenment. It is the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right views, right intent, right speech, right conduct, right means of livelihood, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right meditation. This, brethren, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, decay is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Presence of objects we hate is suffering, separation from objects we love is suffering. Not to obtain what we desire is suffering. And this, brethren, is the noble truth concerning the origin of suffering. Verily, it originates in that craving which causes the renewal of becomings, is accompanied by sensual delight, and seeks satisfaction now here, now there. That is to say, craving for pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for not becoming. This, brethren, is the noble truth concerning the cessation of suffering. Verily, it is passionlessness, sensation, without remainder of this very craving, the laying aside of, the giving up, the being free from, the harboring no longer of this craving. This, brethren, is the noble truth concerning the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. Verily, it is the Noble Eightfold Path. That is to say, right views, right intent, right speech, right conduct, right means of livelihood, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right meditation. In the Buddhist tradition, there are many, many forms of meditation, including guided meditations. And one of those guided meditations, probably the best known, is the loving-kindness meditation, which is a meditation where you seek first compassion for yourself, and then you move out to those you know in your inner circle, and then outer circles, and in the community, and out to the whole world. We're now going to sing a version of that, and it's found at number 1031 in the turquoise supplement. So in song, we will do that. You may remain seated for this hymn. In the mid-1800s, the Unitarian Elizabeth Palmer Peabody published the first Buddhist text to be printed in the English language. Emerson and Thoreau both incorporated Buddhist teachings in their spiritual writing, and the Transcendentalists were fascinated by Buddhism, even though their understanding of it was a little bit distorted. But in spite of those misunderstandings, Buddhism became an increasingly influential force in Unitarianism and later in Unitarian Universalism. Today, many Unitarian Universalists practice the Buddhist spiritual discipline of Zen meditation, study the tradition's sacred texts, and some you use even formally take the precepts to become Buddhists. For many years, there has been an active Unitarian Universalist Buddhist fellowship within our denomination. And this relationship between Unitarian Universalism and Buddhism has not just been a one-way flow. Yes, many Unitarian Universalists have discovered and been enriched by Buddhism, but many practicing Buddhists have also discovered Unitarian Universalism. They often come to us for liberal religious education for their children, for a kind of social engagement that is generally not available in Buddhist practice centers, for vibrant, uplifting, music-filled worship, and to join with others in social justice work. There is a two-directional flow of Unitarian Universalism to Buddhism and Buddhism to Unitarian Universalism, because they each satisfy needs not always met by the other, and because they share some common approaches to life. I believe at the heart of this compatibility is the emphasis that both place on the individual's right to a free and responsible search for truth and the value of self-reliance, self-understanding, and critical thinking. On a personal level, I've experienced this compatibility within my circle of ministerial colleagues. For many years, until because of change in positions, people moved, I was part of a Unitarian Universalist ministers group called the Peabody Group, named after that same woman who brought the first Buddhist text to us. This was a group of six ministers who gathered monthly to exchange ideas and help each other with sermons. Theologically, we embraced many different positions. And one member of the group, the Reverend James Ishmael Ford, is the first person to be ordained as both a Unitarian Universalist minister and a Soto Zen priest. And I'm indebted to him and to his little book, this very moment, for many of the ideas in this sermon. In our sermons today, we cannot touch upon all of Buddhism, but upon just a few ways in which Unitarian Universalism and Buddhism come together. And I should begin, I think, with a caveat, especially for those of you who are more well-versed and more practiced in Buddhism than I am. I'm not going to attempt a complex discussion of the various forms of Buddhism or even try to give you an all-encompassing overview of the topic. Rather, I hope to focus on just a couple of aspects of Buddhism that I believe fit well within our Unitarian Universalist framework. For those of you who would like to explore Buddhism more, particularly as it relates to Unitarian Universalism, I commend James's book to you, and you can get it in the UUA bookstore. As I mentioned earlier, our tradition was drawn to Buddhist thought quite early. During the 19th century, then, though it seemed it was more of a novelty form of intellectual enrichment rather than a real engagement with the tradition. However, as we entered the 20th century, and as the humanist movement grew in our denomination, so did the interest in Buddhism. In Buddhism, those religious humanists found an ancient religion which challenged the then prevailing notion in the comparative study of religions. Here they found an authentic faith tradition that was not directly concerned with the question of God or gods. Here instead was a concept of a non-theistic religion, largely based on a popular Unitarian idea of radical self-reliance. Moreover, in its approach to the world, Buddhism, like humanism, has an emphasis, a strong emphasis, on the here and now. Perhaps you may have heard with sometimes a kind of disturbing Buddhist proverb, the one that says, if you meet the Buddha on the highway, kill him. Humanist Unitarian Universalist minister Edward Atkinson, in referring to that proverb, states, that harsh maxim drives home a vital truth. No holy prophet, Messiah, Christ, avatar, or even great God in heaven can do your spiritual work or your ethical work for you. Free yourself. Be, as the choir is saying, a lamp unto your own salvation. For many humanists, although devoted to reason and scientific inquiry, there was still something missing. As one humanist put it, reason alone is just too short a ladder to truth's full height. In the practice of Zen meditation, people found a religious practice that did not start with a submission to dogma which they rejected or found questionable, but rather focused on a spiritual emptying of those forces in your life which brought you pain and a connecting with your authentic inner being. The meditative practice of Zen provides an authentic spirituality for many humanists to discover the full heights of truth and to integrate the inner and the outer world. But it's not just humanists, or just Unitarian Universalists from other theological perspectives, for that matter, who have begun to engage Buddhism. Today, many Christians are avid Zen practitioners and embrace many Buddhist tenets as well. In his book, Ford tells us of a Catholic Zen practitioner who, when asked how he could do both, replied in this fashion. He first held out his hand palm side up and said, Catholic. And then he turned it over and held it out and said, Zen. In other words, the hand, though seen differently, was whole each time. Ford describes this as the embrace of two 100%. And indeed, I have learned that there are Zen practitioners like this in many different religious traditions besides our own. Many Unitarian Universalists connect to Buddhism primarily through the practice of meditation, the regular practice of presence and an attentiveness that allows us to go deeper into ourselves, with the hope that, to some degree, we will awaken that Buddha mind within us, which can help us to reshape our approach to living. However, it's not just through the practice of meditation that Unitarian Universalists embrace Buddhism. I personally find Buddhism's greatest contribution to Unitarian Universalism in its ethical teachings. Buddhists bring a profound interpretation of many of the principles to which we ascribe as Uyghurs. In the reading from the Buddha's first sermon after enlightenment, we met a man who had been troubled by the pain that the world experiences. The pain or suffering can come, as he said, from both indulgence and deprivation. He sees suffering as all-pervasive in our life. But he also reflects on the suffering, and he concludes that it is real, but it is a symptom. He then approaches this pain sort of in the same way a physician would approach your report of pain in your body. The Buddhist proceeds like a doctor to diagnose the cause of the symptom. In Buddhist terminology, the cause is tanha, the drive for private fulfillment. And the prognosis is good. There is a prescription that will treat the symptoms. It's not a quick fix of a pill or surgery. It's more like physical therapy or athletic training. It's a regimen that must be followed, which is known as the Eightfold Path. In particular, this Eightfold Path that we would all do well to draw on in shaping our lives is, you will remember, right views, right intent, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. And many divide these eight steps into three groups, or sort of independent aspects of enlightenment: morality, meditation, and wisdom. We've already focused on meditation, and I wish to spend the remaining part of the sermon on the moral teachings found in the Eightfold Path, because that is where Buddhism really resonates for many in the UU world. These moral teachings give us a way to take hold of our lives and to focus on how we relate to others. The Eightfold Path is a step-by-step approach to living in right relationship with yourself, those around you, and the whole world. We began on our path with the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths, acknowledging that the suffering is real and it's the product of both excessive indulgence and attachment to material things of the world, and can be the product of deprivation of basic things that we do need for life. To follow this path, you must first decide you want to live your life differently. You have to want to free yourself from some of the distractions and to liberate yourself from some of the clutter in your life. The starting point for the Buddha is the recognition that the power of our mind is what shapes our lives. The Buddha once put it this way, all we are is the result of what we have thought. For the Buddha, it is not sin that we are to overcome in our lives, but it is ignorance. The Buddha wants to liberate us from the mechanical, thoughtless approach to life and instead lead us to a life that is continually self-examined. The Buddhist moral teachings are highly, highly relational. Our individual path to enlightenment only comes about by being in right relationship to the world and to those around us. Our Unitarian Universalist principles, which proclaim respect for the interdependent web of existence, the dignity of every individual, and compassion in human relationships, to name a few, are simply embedded in that Eightfold Path. The Buddha gives us very practical steps to follow in order to live in right relationship with others in the world and thereby live in right relationship to our real selves. It is the way we interact with others that our own destiny is determined. We must practice right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, and all these require right effort. First, we must think about what our speech is revealing about our character. We should think about how often we find it necessary to deviate from the truth. But it is not just truth that should come from our lips. No, not at all. Also kindness and charity. There are, of course, the obvious lies and gossip, but right speech is much more than just avoiding these things. It is equally important to avoid the ways we belittle people or the tactless ways we express ourselves, which are damaging to others and to ourselves as well. If I might marry our principles once again to the Eightfold Path, we should regularly ask ourselves such questions as, did I speak in a way that honored the inherent worth and dignity of the person to whom or about whom I was speaking? That's not an easy task to follow on a day-to-day basis. But by focusing on our speech, we can become more aware of what it may be revealing about our character and then work towards the practice of right speech. But it was not just our words that were the moral concern of the Buddha. We're instructed to live the Buddha life. We must examine our actions and redirect them where necessary. You know, Buddhism has its counterparts in the ethical teachings of the Ten Commandments. The five precepts direct us, do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not be unchaste, do not take drugs or intoxicants. But it's not just observing a negatively worded series of prohibitions that will lead us to right conduct. Our actions, like our speech, need to be directed at fostering the good in ourselves and in others. Our actions, like our words, must demonstrate justice, compassion, and truth. The Buddha encouraged us to engage in those activities and occupations that promote life rather than harm or destroy it. His realization that our jobs occupy most of our time is as true now as it ever was, maybe more so. And therefore, examining the way we make our livelihood is one of the moral considerations in the Eightfold Path. And in this world today of multi-layered cooperation and the need for all of us to have a job which will produce the income to support our families, this can be a particularly difficult moral tenet to apply. But the Buddha tells us that we cannot make spiritual progress if the majority of our day is spent moving in the other direction. The Buddha once wrote, "The hands of the dyer are subdued by the dye in which they work." I personally know this to be true from my own life journey as I moved from a life colored first by my job as an assistant district attorney and later as a civil and criminal defense lawyer and then finally to ministry. And I also know from my own experience how difficult it is to make a change, particularly from a job that provides well. And I'm not suggesting here that you up and leave your job for a career that the Buddha might think more appropriate, although some of you have done that and some of you may still do that, particularly some of you who retire and take on another volunteer career. But I'm suggesting that we examine our jobs that we have and how we do them to see where we can still apply those teachings. It's not just the job, but it's how you do the job. Finally, the Buddha recognizes that both the thoughtfulness and actions required on the Eightfold Path demand a tremendous amount of effort and dedication. Indeed, one of the steps you'll remember is called right effort. The Buddha, speaking to a group of monks, put it this way: "Those who follow the way might well follow the example of an ox that marches through the deep mire carrying a heavy load. He's tired, but his steady, forward-looking gaze will not relax until he comes out of the mire. Only then does he relax. O monks, remember that passion and sin are more than the filthy mire, and you can escape misery only by earnestly and steadfastly persevering in the way." The effort to follow the moral teachings of Buddhism is substantial. But you know, every right thought, right word spoken, right action, as the Buddha said, is a step along the way. Every moment spent in examining the way we live and relate to others is a step towards happiness and peace. On this path, we move away from anger, away from hostility. We crave less the material things of the world. We have greater compassion for others. And we increasingly recognize our interconnection to all creation. As we encounter the winds of change in our lives that will be there, the demands, the disappointments, the confusion, the grief which will come our way, the Buddha says, "No, there is a prescription for the pain. Go deep in right meditation, right thought, right mindfulness, and walk with steady effort on the path of right conduct, right speech, and right livelihood." It is said that no one except the Buddha has reached the full enlightenment of the journey. But it's also said that each step along the way brings its measure of peace and joy.